Tax Update for April 25th, 2009. What's up, Doc? Employee or not? The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to determine what raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. This week, we look at a tax court ruling in the case of Maimon v. Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2009-53, where a physician facing significant legal expenses he paid personally argued that, despite reporting in prior years and reporting in the current year by his employer, that he was not truly an employee of the professional corporation, which, oh, by the way, he also held shares in. The case is somewhat unique because Dr. Maimon was not an officer of the organization, which most often is what torpedoes such claim before the case even begins. But it still in the end didn't save Dr. Maimon as the tax court walked through the various criteria under the standard common law test to determine if Dr. Maimon is an employee or not and decides he is. The court outlines all the general criteria to be considered when the issue of whether or not someone is an employee arises. And in this particular case, it's a good outline of the issues where you may not have a case that's quite as bad facts as this in determining whether or not we have an employment relationship. Why does the issue matter, actually? Well, the tax law has a number of factors that can make being an independent contractor rather than an employee very attractive to an individual. In today's case, the major problem facing our physician is the different treatment of trade or business deductions that are in court as an employee versus those being incurred outside of an employment relationship. Both employees and non-employees generally qualify for deductions for business expenses under Section 162 and related provisions. However, Section 62, which defines what is included in adjusted gross income, immediately makes a distinction between these two classes of individuals. We find in Section 62A that for purposes of this subtitle, the term adjusted gross income means, in the case of an individual, gross income minus the following deductions. So these are the things we get to take off in computing AGI. And the first one is trade or business deductions. But we find out instantly in Section 62A1 that we get to take those above the line if, final clause, such trade or business does not consist of the purpose of the performance of services by the taxpayer as an employee. If you are an employee, your deductions do not come into computing AGI, but rather get pushed down below the line. And matters get worse quickly because this deduction falls into the less than optimal category we know as miscellaneous itemized deductions. In Section 67, we find a 2% haircut imposed on miscellaneous itemized deductions. Now, what exactly are miscellaneous itemized deductions? Well, they're defined by what they're not in Section 67. In Section 67, there's a list of itemized deductions that aren't considered miscellaneous itemized deductions subject to the haircut. And employee business expenses aren't in that blessed list. As well, since it only affects itemized deductions, anything that was blessed in Section 62 to be allowed to be deducted above the line doesn't face the problem of the 2% limitation. But again, employees don't get that blessed benefit. Rather, they're stuck with having to take the deduction below the line. And to add insult to injury, we find that under Section 56B that the following issue arises regarding to computing alternative minimum taxable income. In this particular case, we find that in determining the amount of alternative minimum taxable income, we are not allowed a deduction under Section 56B1A i for any miscellaneous itemized deductions as defined in Section 67. Thus, expenses incurred by an employee as business expenses face the following hurdles and basic problems. First, the expenses do not reduce adjusted gross income. As we're all aware, a number of phase-out and special treatments under the law depend upon your AGI being below certain levels. If you're an employee and you incur expenses, these don't reduce your adjusted gross income. If you were an independent contractor, they would. So you may find if you're an independent contractor, you'd qualify for certain benefits that otherwise you're going to be left out in the cold on because your deduction comes below the line. Second, because it's an itemized deduction, the taxpayer must be able to itemize to get any benefit. If the taxpayer otherwise has insufficient itemized deductions, a portion or all of the employee business expenses that would be deductible will end up being used to absorb the standard deduction the taxpayer would otherwise get regardless of having incurred these expenses. The expenses are also, as mentioned, subject to that 2% haircut on miscellaneous itemized deductions. Again, if the taxpayer doesn't have other miscellaneous itemized deductions sufficient to clear the 2% hurdle, then some of the employee business expenses are going to be consumed in getting to that 2% limit for miscellaneous itemized deductions. Then, as noted, we may have to clear the hurdle for the standard deduction. Finally, if we have enough expenses to clear those hurdles, we may find that the expenses that were significant enough to allow us to get above those hurdles now find us subjected to the alternative minimum tax, which causes us to lose the benefit of some of these expenses. Once we've triggered the AMT, the additional employee business expenses become useless. That's going to be especially true for taxpayers in high income tax states. Those were the issues facing our physician in today's case. Now, this one basically boils down to the fact that lawsuits are costly. Dr. Maiman ran into certain legal difficulties relating to his medical services. They required him to obtain legal services that were not paid for by the practice, and he eventually had to pay a significant settlement. The tax court opinion notes that during 2004, he paid legal fees of $22,155 in connection with a lawsuit filed against him, among others, for medical negligence. In 2004, he settled the lawsuit for $1.4 million with his malpractice insurer agreeing to pay $400,000 and Dr. Maimon getting stuck with paying $1 million. He paid the $1 million settlement during 2005. Now, that's significant because 2004 is the year in question in this examination. During 2004, he also paid membership dues of $440 to the American College of Surgeons Professional Association. He reported total expenses, therefore, of $24,615, consisting of legal fees of $24,175 and the dues of $440 on Schedule C. In September of 2006, he requested that DHN issue an amended W-2 for 2004. DHN is the professional corporation of which Dr. Maiman was a shareholder. DHN's business manager informed Dr. Maiman that the issuance of amended W-2 was not appropriate, and he did not receive such an amended Form W-2 from DHN. For the years 2001 to 2003 and 2005 to 2006, he received Forms W-2s reporting his compensation as wages, tips, and other compensation, and the withholding of federal, state, and local income and paid Social Security and Medicare taxes. 2001 to 2003, he reported that compensation on line 7 as wages and salaries. In 2005, he reported it again on line 7, this time attached to Schedule C, that did not report any gross receipts or sales but claimed expenses of over $1 million, including, as you may expect, the $1 million settlement payment for the medical negligence lawsuit. 2006, he attached a Schedule C to his return, reported gross receipts and sales of $507,944, which is $50 less than what was shown as W-2, and claimed expenses of $992. For that return, he checked the box on line 1 of the Schedule C to incorrectly indicate that his Form W-2 identified him as a statutory employee. Now, while he wasn't terribly consistent from year to year in how he reported things, the goal was obviously to move expenses up above the line once we hit 2004 and Dr. Maimon began incurring significant expenses outside that weren't being reimbursed by the practice. You may wonder about this case being a summary decision, and that's because only 2004 of the $22,000 of legal fees was at issue in the case in question today. But it's clear that his treatment of the prior years would have implications in the future years, especially 2005 with the $1 million payment. If he's still an employee then, he has a potential problem, likely with AMT at that point is where his issue would likely arise. But in our case, we're just worried about the conclusion of was he or was he not an employee, so we want to take a look at this decision. What is an employee? The tax court outlined the basic test for what is an employee as follows. It says factors that are relevant include the degree of control the principal exercise, which party invests in work facilities that the worker used, the worker's opportunity for profit or loss, whether the principal can discharge the worker, whether the work is part of the principal's regular business, the permanency of the relationship, and the relationship the parties believe they were creating. All facts and circumstances of each case are considered, and no single factor is dispositive. The doctor did get one break right away when the tax court started this decision. Corporate officers are, by definition, employees of the corporation they perform services for as an officer. Take a look at Section 3121D1 and Section 3401C for these issues in the FICA and the income tax withholding arena. The tax court didn't buy the IRS claims that Dr. Maimon was an officer. The court notes, although petitioner agreed in his employment shareholder agreements to serve as an officer, he credibly testified that he did not fact serve as an officer during 2004. Neither the shareholder nor the employment agreement assigned any official responsibilities to the petitioner. Respondent has not identified any such duties assigned to the petitioner. So the tax court, having decided that the IRS didn't get the slam dunk by having him be an officer, looked at the common law tests and applied those to Dr. Maimon. The first test involved, as noted, degree of control. It took a look at the degree of control exercised by DHN, the professional corporation, over Dr. Maimon's work. The court explains this factor when we apply it as follows. It says, while no single factor is dispositive, the degree of control the alleged employer exercises over details of work is the crucial test in determining employment status, and it does this by reference to the Webster versus Commissioner case. An employment relationship exists where the principal has the right to control the details, manner, or method of an individual's work. In contrast, an independent contractor is hired to accomplish a specific result, and the principal has a right only to specify the result it desires. It is not necessary for the principal to actually exercise control. It is sufficient that the principal has a right to control. The employer need not stand over the individual and direct every detail of the individual's work. For instance, let's take the example of us in the accounting firm here that I'm in. Clients hire us to handle specific activities, let's say to take care of handling filing of a tax return or doing a specific tax planning engagement. They do not specifically direct my work day to day as to what I'm going to be doing or handle when exactly I'll do it. However, if I was a controller for a private company, then the owner of the company or the president of the company or whatever the position we will put the person in charge is having would have the ability to direct my activities, even though he might not specifically be able to do so. Maybe he doesn't specifically come and tell me what to do. He nevertheless clearly has a right to direct and usually does direct when I will be there and specifically control the specific goals I'm after. That's a key difference in what's an employee versus an independent contractor. Now, Dr. Maimon complained that state law prevented the corporation from exercising control over him because he was a physician. He noted that he maintained Ohio state law prohibited DHN from exercising control in matters related to patient care and treatment. And he referenced Ohio Revised Code, Section 1785.03. DHN did not control or supervise his medical judgment, including patient diagnoses, what medications to prescribe, or what treatments or procedures to perform. He had the discretion to schedule the length of his patient's appointments, to consult with physicians outside of DHN, and to determine whether to continue to treat a patient. He also maintained the ability to choose outside pathologists, laboratories, and other medical services, and to choose the hospitals or surgical centers where he would maintain hospital privileges. He also chose the hospital personnel to assist him, but neither he nor DHN paid the hospital staff. By Dr. Maimon's view, that indicated that he should be an independent contractor. However, the court noted the level of control isn't specified in his test, and that level of control has to be adapted to deal with the specific type of services being rendered. In essence, taking Dr. Maimon's view, a professional could never be an employee, which means no one could be an employee here at the accounting firm, arguably, if in fact all the CPAs have to answer to the State Board of Accountancy for their activities. Nevertheless, the court's not going to go there. It notes the degree of control necessary to find employee status varies with the nature of services the worker provides. The threshold level of control necessary to find employee status is lower when applied to professional services than when provided to non-professional services. An alleged employer control over professional services must necessarily be more tenuous and general than the control over the non-professional employees, the court said, citing James versus Commissioner. And applying that test, it found DHN exercised more than sufficient control to have this test fall into the employee category. The court stated, we do not agree the petitioner was not subject to DHN's control. It noted he was required to work 4.5 days during office hours that DHN set. Although he could choose his half day off, he didn't have the flexibility in his schedule that is indicative of an independent contractor. The employment agreement provided petitioner would render medical services under the supervision of the physician members of DHN. He agreed that all patients belonged to DHN, and he was required to submit patient records to DHN for billing and insurance purposes. He did not provide medical services outside of his relationship with DHN. The court goes on to note, although he exercised his medical judgment when rendering medical services, his methods were directed by professional standards set by the medical community. Because of the lower measure of control applicable to professionals, the fact that DHN did not control his patient's diagnoses and treatment does not preclude a finding that DHN exercised sufficient control over petitioner to establish an employment relationship. We find that DHN had a right of control over petitioner sufficient to find an employment relationship. As the court noted, this is the most significant test, and having lost this test, Dr. Maiman now faces a real uphill battle trying to show he's not an employee when we go down and check the other tests. But let's go on to them because the court discussed each one. And the next test we need to consider is investment in facilities by the worker or by the entity that we believe may be the employer. The court noted that DHN appeared to have made a significant investment in facilities and supporting staff necessary to Dr. Maiman's medical practice. It noted that, in general, the fact a worker provides his own equipment indicates independent contractor status. In this case, Dr. Maiman provided medical services only at the offices that DHN had leased and in hospital or surgical facilities where he had staff privileges. The employment agreement provided DHN would pay for his hospital staff dues. He did not provide medical services outside of the facilities provided or paid for by DHN. DHN, the court noted, also provided clerical, central billing, and purchasing staff. Dr. Maiman did try to claim the situation wasn't entirely one-sided. He did provide some things, but the court continued. He testified that he provided some specialized equipment used to treat patients. However, DHN also leased medical communications and computer equipment and other fixtures used in its office locations. Similarly, the hospitals and medical centers where he performed procedures provided necessary equipment. He did not quantify his investment in equipment relative to DHN's. Any investment by petitioner is offset by DHN investments in office locations and equipment and the payment of hospital dues. Moreover, petitioner did not use the equipment to provide medical services for a fee outside of his relationship with DHN. This factor supports employment status. Note that the court was interested here with the fact that he basically only performed his services through DHN. While not specifically stated, that certainly does indicate a problem. It's much better if you're going to try to get non-employee status to have more than one customer. If you have a single customer, that begins to look a lot more like an employee structure. The court next moved on to the opportunity for profit or loss. Individuals who are in a business for themselves generally face the risk of both profit. They face the risk of a loss plus the opportunity to profit basically in full from their services. As the court notes, an opportunity for profit or loss indicates non-employee status. It cites Simpson versus Commissioner. On the other hand, earning an hourly wage or fixed salary indicates an employer-employee relationship exists. The court found that this factor in this case actually weighed in favor of finding Dr. Maiman was an independent contractor, as it quite often would in the case of a professional and professional services corporation. And let's not forget, he got nailed for the $1 million payout for the judgment against him, or for the settlement, we should say, against him. So clearly, he not only had the risk of a loss, but it appears that in 2005, he had a loss. The court noted, pursuant to the employment agreement, the petitioner agreed that DHN was entitled to any fees arising from his medical services. The employment agreement guaranteed him a base salary regardless of the number of patients he saw or the amount of medical fees he generated. There was no requirement to generate a certain level of patient fees to receive a bonus or an increase in base salary. Rather, he received pay bonuses based on the annual net profits of DHN and not on the amount of medical fees he personally generated. The employment agreement provides that each shareholder physician would receive the same amount of total annual compensation. If petitioner increased the amount of medical fees he generated, the increase would be shared equally by all doctors at DHN. His opportunity was profit was as a shareholder of DHN rather than from rendering medical services. Further, he did not perform any medical services for a fee outside of his relationship. Petitioner had some risk of loss as a shareholder of DHN if DHN operated as loss. The fact that petitioner incurred an individual loss on the settlement was a business decision he made, but it supports a finding he had a risk of loss. Therefore, this factor as a whole favors independent contractor status. Unfortunately for Dr. Maimon, this is going to be about the only one that did. And we should note that for most professionals, we could find a very similar finding in most accounting, law firms, medical practices, that in fact there is a risk of profit and loss. Those who are shareholders generally, as I mentioned to individuals in that position, you get whatever's left over at year end, and if there's nothing left over, you get to basically chip in to give enough to make the company work through the end of the year. Let's talk next, though, about the next thing the court looked at, which was the rights to terminate the relationship. Generally, a right of either party to terminate the relationship at will suggests an employment status, since employment is generally at will. The court explains, in determining employment status, courts consider the manner in which a relationship can be terminated, by one or both parties at any time, with or without notice. The right to discharge a worker and the worker's right to quit at any time indicates employee status. The court went on to look at the relationship between Dr. Maimon and DHN. Under the terms of the shareholder employment agreement, DHN had the right to discharge petitioner by vote of all except one of the shareholders, with or without cause and without notice. Obviously, all but one means that he doesn't get to veto his own dismissal. Upon termination, DHN would be required to pay petitioner a wage continuation payment of $120,000 for his prior services to DHN. Similarly, Dr. Maimon could terminate the relationship with DHN with or without cause, although he was required to give 60 days notice of his resignation. A unilateral notice requirement on the part of the worker, the court notes, does not support independent contractor status. That cited Chaplin versus Commissioner. But it also notes that for contrary opinion, you might want to take a look at Levine versus Commissioner, where a notice by alleged employer will support independent contractor status. The court goes on to note his right to receive a wage continuation payment upon termination is at best a neutral factor. The employment agreement provided that the payment be for past services. It would not constitute a payment for breach of contract or petitioner's right to perform future services under the contract. Both parties to the employment agreement had the right to terminate the relationship with or without cause, and DHN, the corporation, could terminate that relationship without notice. This factor supports a finding of employment status. That made it look more like, rather than a contractual agreement where a client comes to me and signs me up to do the tax return for him, and I agree to do it, where we have a contractual relationship where if I call him up and say, now, no, I'm not going to do the return for you out of the blue, that probably is going to get a breach of contract problem for me. But as an employee, the employees on my staff, if they decide tomorrow that they want to quit, generally they have the right to do so. And that's the difference between employment status and a non-employment status. Next, we look at, was what Dr. Maimon did an integral part of the business of DHN? That factor the court dealt with very quickly, because it's fairly clear that DHN needed physicians to be a medical practice. The court notes integrations of worker services into the business operation of the alleged employer indicates employee status. DHN was in the business of providing medical services. Petitioner, as a physician member, is integrally involved in that business. That fact supports a finding that petitioner was an employee of DHN. Note, the situation might have been different if the individual was an accountant who was performing services for the medical practice, preferably an accountant with other clients to deal with, but an accountant would have a different rule because his work's not so integral to the medical practice. The permanency of a relationship is also, and it's kind of a trade-off versus the one we talked about earlier with the right to dismiss, but employees, in addition to having a right to dismissal and in addition to having the right to quit, there is nevertheless a pretty good belief continuing every day that we're going to continue this relationship for the indefinite future. In the case of a contractor, when a client signs up to do the return, we have a relationship just for the period of doing that return generally, and then they still have to decide if they're going to come back next year and do the return again with me. But that's a different relationship. We basically break it off. It's not meant to be permanent, ongoing, and continuing forever. Now, those of us in practice, as I said, no clients come and go. But many clients come in to handle a specific problem, and once we address that problem, we're done. Employees do expect the relationship to be at least somewhat permanent. The employee will work generally exclusively for the employer on a continuing basis. Dr. Maimon's patients came and went, but Dr. Maimon kept showing up at DHN every day. That indicated a potential issue of him being an employee. In this case, therefore, as you might suspect, the court found an expectation of permanent relationship. The court notes a continuing relationship indicates an employment relationship, while a transitory relationship weighs in favor of independent contractor status. The party's contemplation of a continuing relationship indicates an employment relationship. In contrast, a relationship established to accomplish a specific objective is indicative of independent contractor relationship. As I noted, for instance, preparing a single tax return indicates independent contractor. Being the guy in charge of day-to-day operations in an accounting office involved with, let's say, a construction company, where I handle accounts payable, receivable, supervise those people, and go ahead and take care of all the things on a continuing basis, that indicates more of an employment relationship for the account. The court goes on to note that in his pretrial memorandum, Dr. Maimon acknowledged that the doctors at DHN intended a long-lasting relationship, but he argued that fact's not significant. He had a long-term relationship with DHN. He joined it as a shareholder in 1999. The employment agreement contemplated an initial 3-year term with automatic 1-year renewals thereafter. The court decided that given the continuing nature of this relationship, the factor supported a finding of employee status. Finally, we consider what was the intent of the parties when they entered into this relationship. In this case, until expenses arose, Dr. Maimon and DHN both seemed to believe this was an employer-employee relationship, and DHN continued to operate under that belief. The court notes the parties clearly intended to create an employment relationship. The employment agreement expressly identified a petitioner as employee of DHN. By the way, if you want to claim you're not an employee, it's probably best not to sign an employment agreement. DHN reported petitioner's compensation on Form W-2 and withheld income, Social Security, and Medicare taxes consistent with this expressed intent. Dr. Maimon did not make quarterly estimated tax payments. That's also something he would have expected if he was a contractor. For the years 2001 through 2003, DHN similarly reported the compensation on Form W-2 and withheld taxes. For these years, Dr. Maimon reported the compensation as wages on Line 7 of Form 1040 and did not report the income or expenses on Schedule C, as he suddenly started doing in 2004. The court also noted that DHN provided employment benefits to petitioner, including paid vacation and holidays. I don't know about you, but my clients don't generally pay for my vacations and holidays. Medical and disability insurance, participation in a retirement plan, and malpractice insurance. Although now considering it, maybe it would be nice to say, yeah, add to each client, we're going to add X hours to cover my vacation for the year. So, you know, we'll just bill you for that while I'm on vacation. You'll pay for this hour. The next guy pays for the next one. Most of us would probably find that most of our clients wouldn't be thrilled with that concept. It should also note, the court went on to note, that DHN agreed to reimburse petitioner for the cost of continuing education classes. The court noted that he did not include in his gross income the contributions to the retirement account or any of these other benefits, to be honest. When DHN refused his amended W-2, it indicated he was a statutory employee. Those factors, the court notes, indicate an employment relationship. As the court noted, in many circumstances, and certainly for anything for which it was a benefit, Dr. Maimon continued to operate as if he was an employee. Not surprisingly, then, in conclusion, the court found he was an employee. It summarized that we find the petitioner is a common law employee of DHN. It's found that he entered into a contract with DHN that expressly identified him as an employee. Consistent with that intent, petitioner received a fixed salary without regard to the medical fees he generated, received paid vacation, employee benefits, reimbursement for expenses, participated in an employee retirement plan, and received Form W-2 reporting his compensation. Petitioner was required to work normal office hours, maintained a long-term relationship with DHN, and did not perform medical services for a fee except for his DHN patients. DHN provided his office space, paid for hospital staff privileges, and provided a substantial portion of his medical equipment. Petitioner accepted his employee classification with DHN for prior years as defined in the employment agreement, but sought to change that treatment once faced with the enormous expense from the employment-related lawsuit and settlement in 2004 and 2005. The fact that petitioner was a medical professional with discretion to exercise professional judgment in patient care and treatment does not negate the strong evidence showing he was a common law employee of DHN. As a common law employee, petitioner must report his compensation from DHN on Form 1040, Line 7, and is not entitled to deduct the claim business expenses on Schedule C. He must claim the business expenses on Schedule A as unreimbursed employee business expenses subject to the 2% limitation for miscellaneous itemized expenses. In this case, the key issue was the fact he was going to lose the entire deduction for the legal fees because he wasn't going to get over the 2% limitation in 2004. But as we noted earlier, for other individuals, a key problem can be the AMT impacts of this or the loss of other benefits that they may qualify for if their AGI was only lower. What lessons can we draw from this case? Probably should note this case represents extremely bad facts going in for the doctor who is trying to claim non-employee status. But it's interesting because the court didn't simply dismiss that claim instantly, but actually went through and analyzed the criteria, which are the same criteria we need to be concerned about whenever we have an individual who may have a less clear-cut case as to whether they are an employee or an independent contractor. Let's not forget, though, a number of bad facts that showed up for Dr. Maiman, and which will be bad facts for your client as well if you find them in your situation. He never objected to be treating his employee in prior year. He took advantage of benefits only open to employees from the entity, and then ended up reporting on his return to statutory employee at one point, even though he clearly failed to meet those requirements, and the W-2 itself never indicated he was a statutory employee. Tax positions that are not consistent from year to year and seem driven primarily by the tax benefit of the moment don't fare well in court. I should also notice that a week ago we had a couple of cases where if you try to change your mind down the line, that didn't work too well either. We had appellate cases come down in the case of United States versus Fletcher, where a person tried to restructure what had been a sale of a partnership interest, claiming that in fact due to restrictions she didn't truly sell the whole interest in the year of sale. That became a big deal because by the time the restrictions lapsed, what had happened was the value of what she had received, which was shares of stock, dropped very precipitously. So she would have paid much lower tax if she could move that to the later year. And Bassing versus United States, where an individual tried to claim that what had been treated as a reduction in debt, basically partnership redemption, sale of partnership interest for removal from liability for debt of the partnership, down the line, years after the statute had closed on everyone else, he tried to claim it was in fact a discharge of indebtedness because he was insolvent. That was the Bassing case from the Federal Circuit. That particular case, the court found that it was a partnership item, but the same basic issue arose here. In both cases, we had individuals that reported one way and then turned back around, and when they discovered later it would have been to their benefit to do it another, tried to make that change. As well, the fact in Dr. Maiman's case that the corporation itself refused to change its reporting didn't bode well for Dr. Maiman. But it does seem to indicate that someone noticed that if the corporation got into this mess and changed the way it reported for him, they themselves could be dragged into big problems and issues that they probably preferred to ignore. The court doesn't go into a whole lot of detail about why Dr. Maiman was paying these fees themselves, though it suggests he did so on a business decision that might be preferred was suggested by the other physicians in the group. Remember, they all evenly split the profits of the company, and if the company ended up eating Dr. Maiman's legal fees and the $1 million settlement, probably a lot of people would have had a significantly reduced bonus in the year 2005. Clearly, ignoring the tax aspects, though, it would not seem normal that you want to expose yourself to the expense of litigation, ultimate settlement voluntarily. So it's extremely likely there are other facts that were not mentioned in this case that led to the result where Dr. Maiman was paying these expenses personally. Now, if we have a situation arise with our clients, how do we solve this problem? Well, if the parties had agreed to have the corporation handle the defense and pay for the eventual settlement, the tax result would have been much better. Employers are allowed to pay for business expenses legitimately incurred by employees in handling the business of the employer. That is a working condition fringe allowed under Section 132A3. As well, under an accountable plan, the employer could have reimbursed the expenses even if the doctor had originally paid for them himself. That's an accountable plan that meets the requirements of Section 62C. Note, however, that neither type of benefit is subjected to any type of non-discrimination requirement. So we could have it where only the owner or owners would be subject to reimbursement or payment of these expenses, and other individuals might be required to basically foot the bill themselves. But if you go these routes, be very careful of one thing. We have to watch not falling into the trap of designing what's essentially a non-qualified cafeteria plan, where the person is allowed to do this, but he agrees to reduce his salary dollar for dollar. in that case, if in fact he had the right to take cash but elected not to and go for these benefits instead, that gets us into constructive receipt problems. And the only way to avoid the constructive receipt problems is for the specific limited list of benefits allowed under Section 125, and it has to be with a plan qualifying under 165. In general, if I give up compensation in exchange for some other benefit, even if that benefit would be non-taxable, I have to include that in income under constructive receipt. Only a Section 125 plan allows us to specifically reduce salary dollar for dollar. You need to be careful in this case because, especially in professional relationships, you may find that the group or the doctors want to write the deal specifically so that we'll go ahead and we'll pay for these legal fees, quote, we'll pay for them, we will pay for them, we'll reimburse you for them, but you're going to take that dollar for dollar out of your compensation. That presents significant risks. Well, as I've noted, I'm still over on Twitter. Had a few extra people, have some more people following me. So if you're on Twitter, Ed Zollars is the name, E-D-Z-O-L-L-A-R-S on Twitter. If you haven't followed Twitter or figured it out, it's tough to explain, just easier to do and follow. There are some interesting people to follow on Twitter among tax interests and other areas. So if you have an area of interest, it's useful to go there. I'm also getting ready to begin here shortly. In fact, beginning at the end of May, I'll start my CP lecturing year. My year begins in Williamsburg, Virginia, where we'll talk for Virginia for a conference there where I'll give a luncheon talk on gadgets. I do my tech talk then. But then I start coming back. We have a few dates here in Phoenix. I believe my first conference here, my first situation here in Phoenix is going to be related to construction contracting. And then I start picking up a number of states around. I have a number of dates this year in California. A few dates in other locations as well going around the country. So it'll be an interesting time, and I look forward to seeing you if you're out there. I've got a couple of days in Oklahoma coming up over the summer, and then as we get to the main CPE season later in the year, obviously things begin to pick up. I'll also be doing a couple of four-hour ethics presentations here in Arizona this year. I'll be producing ethics along with an Arizona tax update. And those will be taking place in Phoenix, Tucson, Yuma, and Prescott during the year, so you check the Arizona catalog if you see that to get ready for this. This update, as always, has been brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to consider going there and consider subscribing to get their updates on developments in tax law. That's especially true as we're now seeing situations develop where we may see a final resolution of the estate tax repeal or non-repeal that we had in 2001. Again, www.lineberg-services. This has been the Tax Update.